My sister goes historical when she see a spider.
Fatima, if I am hungry between meals, I eat a snack.
Ahmed,
a boa constrictor is a poisonous snack.
But they taught me many things too. I was fascinated by their lives and culture, so different from ours. For example, I had noticed that the girls who wore hijabs seemed to have masses of hair piled up on top of their heads. I asked Zainab how long her hair was under her hijab.
"Miss," she said, "it's not very long. We all wear very, very big hair clips on the top of our heads. We like that humpy look. Very trendy, miss. It's the style."
That day, my class was writing letters in response to those sent from England by the Jin twins.
"Miss," said Mustafa Camel, "miss, give me another. This one says his father is a fisherman. He is poor, miss."
I was shocked, but Mustafa Camel wasn't the only one to complain.
"Miss, this one's father is a chef. Miss, this one has no car."
I reprimanded them severely. In fairness, it wasn't their fault. They'd been raised to consider themselves superior to poorer people. They were also blatantly racist, and the very mention of India had them scornfully wobbling their heads and laughing. I resolved, sometime in the future, to show them my favourite YouTube clip, Where the Hell is Matt? It shows a young man doing a silly dance around the world, joined by people from every race and creed, from Papua New Guineans to Buddhist monks. I can't watch it without shedding a tear, and I hoped that maybe it would teach them something. At the end of term, I did find time to show them the clip. Some got it, most didn't. "I can't believe how racist they are," I said to Hawa.
She shrugged. "Tell me about it," she said. "See, your skin is darker than mine."
She compared her pale arm with my tanned one.
"But I lower in their eyes because I'm Malaysian. Now I have their respect because they now forgot my race. But next year, new kids and I start again."
Sometimes life seemed very unfair. My classes completed their letters to be sent to England. They'd been warned not to mention the troubles, as I suspected the authorities would censor any outgoing mail. I didn't want to be responsible for getting the school into any trouble. The following are a few examples.
"Dear Molly, my name is Fatima, and I am a straight A student. My favourite subjects are math, with Miss Hawa, and art. My art teacher takes my canvases to galleries and stuff. I have really curly hair, and the boys sometimes call me chicken noodles. It is brown, and so are my eyes. My favourite colour is cyan. I don't have a brother or a sister, but I don't really want one. I live next to the seashore, too. I'm really good at swimming, but we never swim in the ocean, only our pool, which is very big. When I was 7, I had a swimming test, but the light was bad, so I didn't win. But I cried for a long time. I have experienced a lot of sports, such as tennis, basketball, karate, and ping-pong. My house has a gym and tennis court. I speak Arabic, French, and English fluently. What languages do you speak? Your friend, Fatima."
"Hey, Rose. I read your letter. It was good. You have a lot of animals in your house."
"Why you have a lot of animals in your house?"
"My uncle has a falcon that bites me. I'm unpleased about what is going on in Bahrain. I am Muslim, not Catholic. I love watching TV. I watch it so much I have to wear glasses. I like to go on holiday, and we are going to Syria this year. I like Manchester United, Liverpool, Arsenal, Barcelona. I like chocolate and keep it in my closet. I have amazing friends, but one is mysterious. Please write back, Mustafa. P.S. I am a boy. P.P.S. I've seen pictures of your beach and pier. I live on an island in a very big house."
"Hello, Liam. I don't know how to play British Bulldog. I love watching TV and football, but I can't play because I am fat. I have a brother called Yusuf, and he is annoying. I have a brother called Ahmed, and sometimes we wrestle in bed. I like to play drums. Do you play a instrument? My favorite subject is English, except when Ms. Vicky is in a bad mood. Our teachers are nice, but some are not. My best friends are Mohammed R, Mohammed Y, Mohammed A, and Mustafa. But he's not speaking to me now. Okay, bye, Mohammed.
Dear Ben, I got your letter and I'm going to answer it now. Bahrain is really peaceful, but there are some people who want Bahrain to be for another country and they make road bollocks. My favorite food is pizza. I like it a lot. I like to play with my PlayStation, and I am very addicted to it. My maid makes nice hot dogs. Hassan.
Oh, dear. My English teaching and my careful focus on spelling and vocabulary hadn't seemed to have made much of an impression. Sighing, I slipped the letters into an envelope and posted them to the Gin Twins in England. The 12th of May was another Bahrain day. All the students were dressed in red and white, the colours of the Bahraini flag. A table was set up in the courtyard, manned by some older high school boys. They were inviting the middle school children to write comments in a big open book. "What is that book?" I asked one of my students.
"Mees, you write your name in the book, and your phone number, mees, if you love the king."
I turned away. The book made me feel uncomfortable. At the high school, tempers were becoming frayed. Already short of teachers, some of the younger ones frequently took days off, leaving others to cover for them. Exams were looming, and both students and teachers alike were irritable.
"I know all my students are going to fail," Joe said gloomily. "They refuse to do any homework, and they never study in class, and that's a lie. Honestly, I despair."
"What's he done this time?"
"I asked him for his homework, and he told me to wait a minute. Then, he thought I hadn't noticed, he tears off a corner of his exercise book and scribbles something in pencil. So I ask him again for his homework, and he brings up this note."
"What did it say?" Joe shook his head.
"Word for word, it said, 'Talal is sick today, signed Talal's mother.' It was so ridiculous, I just laughed."
"Hey, I nearly got into trouble today," said Colton. "I was eating sunflower seeds with my students, and you know they're banned because of the mess. Anyway, Miss Tarina comes in. She stands in the doorway, glaring round at them all, and sees a couple of students eating seeds, and she bawls them out. She looks at me, but I've got a mouthful, so I just nod and use my eyes for expression. Got away with it, I think."
We were in Smoker's Corner, escaping from the school building. Our chairs were ones that had been thrown out, tatty-looking but usable. The chairs stayed out at night, as it never rained, but this morning one of them was damp and smelled strongly of cat. We assumed that feral cats slept on the chairs at night, and that particular chair had been watered by an especially pungent Tom. Rashida's familiar footsteps clopped around the corner. She paused to pry out her half-cigarette from the wall, and squinting held her lighter to its ragged end. Then she spotted Colton and quickly replaced the stub in its hiding place.
"Ah, Colton, give me cigarette. I leave mine in the classroom."
Colton rolled his eyes at us, but handed her one. She lit it and looked for a chair to sit down.
"Here you go,"
said Colton, eyes large with innocence.
"Come and sit here."
He gestured to the stinky chair. Rashida plonked herself down, wriggling her voluminous backside, making herself comfy. It was hard to keep a straight face. She inhaled deeply.
"Look, I have new trouser. I queue at city centre. They were making a very nice bargain. 2 trouser for just 6 BD.
We admired them, but it was difficult not to laugh.
"Have you signed your letter of intent yet?"
she asked, looking around at us all.
"Today I sign my contract. I am coming back."
So yet again the school had forgiven her for her misdemeanours. I wasn't surprised, as they were desperately short of teachers. I suspected, too, they'd keep Rita.
the fat lady who'd been so rude to Darina. Darina had confided in me, straight after the spring break, that she wasn't coming back. She'd had enough. ASS would be looking for a new high school principal, although they didn't know it yet.
"I'm coming back," said Colton, "unless I find another job, but that's not likely."
Apparently teaching posts all across the United States were hard to come by. They both looked at Jeremy. We discussed it many times, but still hadn't decided definitely whether to leave or not. I knew that Joe was desperate to go, but he was handing the final decision to me. I was in an agony of indecision. To make matters more difficult, we knew that Colton and Jake would be returning to Bahrain after the summer, and would be very disappointed if we did not. Our friendship with them had grown very strong. Breaking the bonds would be difficult.
Joe shrugged. "We're not sure," he said. "We haven't made our minds up yet. It depends."
A low-flying helicopter's blades whipped his words away.
"What did you say?"
shouted Colton, and Rashida leaned in, cupping an ear. That helicopter decided me. I suddenly knew what to do, and took a deep breath. "We're not coming back," I said clearly, as the helicopter swung away. I caught Joe's look of astonishment and relief. "We're going to hand in our letter of resignation and go back to Spain." That night, we wrote the letter. "Dear Ms. Naima, please accept this as our formal notification that we are resigning from ASS as high school math stroke physics teacher and grade 6 English teacher, and will not be returning in August 2011. This decision was not an easy one, but we have decided that we would like to return to our home in Spain and retire. We very much appreciate the opportunities we have been given here, and the welcome and support the school has given us. We wish ASS every success in the future. Yours sincerely, Joseph and Victoria Tweed." We pinned up a calendar in the kitchen, so that we could cross off the days until we would be back in Spain. All we had to do now was stay in one piece.
"But first we had to make it through exam time, and with students like ours, this was not going to be easy."
Chapter 27 Exams and Cheating. There was no doubt about it. Talal was Joe's most troublesome student. Both his parents were doctors and very supportive, and Talal was bright, but he was lazier than a comatose camel.
"Talal," said Joe in the classroom one day, "have you done those study questions I set you?"
"Yes, Mr. Joe, honestly."
"Then where are they?"
"At home, mister, I swear to God. You can ask my mother."
"Okay, Talal, I'll phone her and just check."
"Yes, mister, she'll tell you."
"What is your mother's telephone number, Talal?"
"No problem, mister. I'll just look."
Talal starts fiddling with his BlackBerry.
"Oh, I just remembered. My mother, she changed her number."
"You're getting an F for that assignment, Talal," said Joe,
and firmly updated his gradebook. Talal's parents despaired of their son's lack of achievement. In an effort to improve his grades, Talal's father suggested that Joe should teach him the topics covered, and then he could help his son at home. This worked quite well. The pair of them could be seen in the school library on many a day, Joe's bald head almost touching the father's headdress, as they pored over pages of calculations together. Did Talal's grades improve?
They did not.
When the troubles in Bahrain escalated and doctors and hospitals were targeted, Talal's family made the decision to move to Canada. Daily, the problems in Bahrain intensified, and the hospitals were the scene of much violence. Talal's family decided to bring their moving date forward, and needed Talal to sit the exams early. To enter a good college in Canada, Talal first had to pass his exams at ASS. A special paper had to be prepared for him.
"I've already written my exam papers," Joe growled, scratching his nethers in annoyance. "And now I have to write another one, just for Talal. As if I don't have enough to do."
He wrote another paper, however, and administered it himself.
Talal sat in front of him in an empty room, nervously waiting to start.
"Talal, are you ready?" asked Joe.
"Yes, Mr. Joe. Mr. Joe, did I tell you that you are the best teacher ever?"
"Here's the paper, Talal. You can start now."
Talal finished his two-hour paper in barely 35 minutes.
"Are you sure you've finished?" asked Joe. "Have you attempted all the questions and checked through your answers?"
"Yes, mister, I've finished."
He handed his paper to Joe.
"Mr. Joe?"
"Yes, Talal?"
"Tell my mother that I love her."
"Behave yourself, Talal. It's just an exam, not worth committing suicide over."
"Okay, mister."
Talal pulled a long face, sighed, and left the room. That evening, Joe marked the paper, which didn't take long. At the top of the first page, Talal had written,
"Mr. Joe, I love you so much. Please give me a good mark. I am sorry I was bad in your class."
Joe flicked on, and there were messages on almost every page of the script.
"Mr. Joe, I know this answer is wrong, but you can see I tried."
And,
"Mr. Joe, please be kind."
On the last page, Talal had written,
"Mr. Joe, I am begging you. I must get 60% or my dad will kill me. I know you can't live with that on your mind because you are a wonderful person."
Talal's paper scored 23%, and Joe was being generous. Talal came to collect his grades and say goodbye, as he and his family were leaving the next day.
"Mr. Joe, look, you have made a very terrible mistake. You have given me only 23%.
"Yes, Talal."
"But I tried my hardest."
"Talal, your paper was dreadful. You know you didn't work for it. I gave you 23% and you hardly deserved that."
"But, mister, that's an F."
"Yes, Talal."
Talal begged and pleaded until finally, knowing that he was starting a new life in Canada, Joe generously raised it to a D.
"I'm changing it because I know you can do much better," he said. "And you make me laugh. Now, go away and good luck in Canada."
2 days later, while Joe was teaching, his phone rang. It was Talal, phoning from the plane heading toward Canada.
"Mr. Joe, why you give me a D?"
"Because that's all you deserve, Talal. In fact, you should have been given an F."
Deep sigh.
"Okay, mister. Have a nice life."
And he hung up. We never heard any more from Talal. No doubt he is now tormenting his Canadian teachers. Cheating amongst the students was legendary, as we discovered very early on at ASS. My middle school pupils cheated as a matter of course, and didn't consider it a great crime. They routinely copied from each other, wrote answers on their hands or ankles, and the girls expertly slipped cheat sheets inside their hijabs. Often, older brothers and sisters or parents would do their homework. I once had a note from a mother complaining that the homework I set was too hard and that it had kept the maid up all night. Even marks entered into grade books weren't immune. One day Joe momentarily turned his back to write on the board, leaving his grade book open on his desk. A little mouse of a girl swiftly erased her own grades, substituting them with much better ones. He only discovered the forgery when he noticed the sevens were not crossed, which he always did. Cheating in the high school was sophisticated and intensified as the exams approached. Darina discovered that the photocopier man was making a tidy profit, printing off extra copies of the questions, then selling them to the students. Teachers were warned never to leave papers in unlocked desks or in unattended bags. Students used their smartphones to snap pictures of the exam questions. One teacher was careless, and his department's exam paper soon circulated round the school. He denied it, and poor Andrea was blamed. We knew the truth, but the teacher never confessed. Few people knew that he was responsible, not Andrea. As a result, the questions were scrapped, and Andrea had to rewrite the paper, much to her annoyance. Many of the teachers were also guilty. They freely handed out questions to their classes, or created study guides with questions identical to those in the final exam. Halle Barry included exam questions in emails he sent to his students. He thought he got away with it, until a few honest students reported him. Halle Berry accused another member of his department of hijacking his computer. All nonsense, of course. And he was issued with yet another formal warning letter. Dyrena was forced to create new exams, not allowing teachers to see the questions until the day of the exam. During exams, cheating was easy. In multi-choice question exams, the students developed a code of foot-tapping, or coughs, so that everybody knew which answer to circle. Even with two invigilators, or proctors, as the Americans call them, per room, it was impossible to watch every student all the time, the exams being held in small and often overcrowded classrooms. It was a simple matter for students to see their neighbours' answers, even while seemingly looking at their own. One teacher had a brainwave. He set up a dummy TV camera at the front of the room and warned the students they were being filmed. The students were forbidden the use of mobile phones. However, they couldn't be searched, particularly the girls, and many cell phones slipped through. That meant they could text each other. Dyrena devised a system that seated students alphabetically, with each exam room allocated a letter of the alphabet. Students of different ages and sitting different subjects were mixed together in the same classroom. It did cure the problem of students seeing each other's work, but not that of smuggled-in mobile phones. It was also a nightmare for the invigilators. One student, sitting algebra, would complain that graph paper was needed, and another that a map was missing from his world history exam. "How was your day?" I asked Joe, as Jazim drove us home after the first day of exams. "Terrible," he groaned. "I got M, and had a whole room full of Mohammeds." Jazim was driving particularly erratically that afternoon. A Range Rover pulled out in front of us, and Jazim screeched to a halt. Spitting Arabic, he thumped the dashboard with his outsized fist and jumped out of the cab. We watched as he and the other driver bawled at each other, waving their arms. "What is he saying?" I asked. "Oh," said Sajja, fluent in Arabic. "The other driver questioned Jasim's parentage, and Jasim told him he drove like a castrated camel." The next morning the bus was early, rare for Jasim, but the figure in the driver's seat looked unfamiliar. We climbed on, curious to know where Jasim was. This driver was polite, but spoke no English. When we were all seated, he pushed the button and the door didn't close. Joe jumped up and showed him how to operate the stick and poked the door closed. Sajja chatted with the driver, then turned to speak to us. "Jasim's getting married today," she smiled. Ah, that explained Jasim's absence today and his testiness yesterday. Once the exams were over, the time for the high school trips began. The destinations of these trips were usually European. Accompanying teachers travelled for free, so places were much sought after. In our group, only Colton was lucky enough to be selected. "Colton, how did your trip go?" I asked. Colton and Essam had accompanied a school trip to Italy, via a stop in Cairo.
"Ah," he said, with a chilled Bennigan's Coors in his hand. "I'm telling you, it didn't start good. At Cairo airport, I had to queue in a different lane because I'm American. The kids were standing in a separate line, parallel to me, laughing their heads off, because I was with the Indians and everybody else. My line was three times the size of theirs. I got the last laugh, though."
"Why?"
"Because one of our students' names was Ali Khalil, and that's the name of a wanted terrorist."
"Ali Khalil?" interrupted Joe. "The same Ali you and I teach."
"Yep." "That's ridiculous," he said, spluttering beer. "For goodness sake. Ali, he's by far my best student, as well as the best behaved." "Tell me about it," Colton continued. "And our Ali's only 15. Our lot were delayed for hours. Except for one of our girls who had a different coloured passport. She's the daughter of some minister here, and she got waved straight through." "How about you, Jake?" asked Joe. "How on earth did you get picked for a trip? One minute you were here, and the next we heard you were in Spain."
As always, Jake took his time and demonstrated his talent for storytelling. You know, when I was at high school myself, our teacher took 12 of us on an amazing tour of Spain and France. I can remember thinking at the time how incredible it would be if someday I, too, had the opportunity to take young people on trips abroad. You know, to appreciate other cultures.
The rest of us were grinning already.
Good grief. Jake rolled his eyes. So, how did you suddenly get picked for this Spanish trip? Joe asked again. Well, good grief. When the hall monitor whispered to me in an ominous tone that Mrs. Sherazy wanted to see me in her office, I thought I was in trouble.
We all nodded.
So I was summoned, and I go up in the elevator to the third floor. Rowan, my head of department, is already there, and we're made to wait with that secretary with purple hair for 15 minutes until Mrs. Sherazy is ready to see us. Have you ever seen Mrs. Sherazy's office?
We all shook our heads.
No kidding. You could easily put Colton's, dog's bodies and my classroom into it, plus a few more, and it's still bigger than that. We teach the future of Bahrain in classrooms one-tenth of the size of that office. Good grief. Rowan has already told me that the Arabic teacher who was supposed to be going on the trip didn't have his visa sorted. So Mrs. Sherazy was asking yours truly, no, telling yours truly, to take his place. She leans forward and says,
"Jacob, you are leaving tomorrow for Spain. You will be at the airport at 8:45 p.m. sharp. You will keep me informed of our students."
I didn't have a chance to respond before she rattled off in Arabic for 10 more minutes to Rowan. So that was that. I'm off to Spain. No questions asked.
You didn't mind, though, did you?
I asked. What? An historical trip for 10th graders? I teach world history, so I was excited. I had my reservations about a trip with Rowan, though. Rowan is, as we all know, well, batshit crazy. She's terrifying and everyone stays out of her way. But she likes me. Or she did, so that helped.
How was Spain? Did your kids behave? Jake guffawed and set down his glass in readiness for the tale. Secretly, I was very jealous of his trip to Spain, while Joe and I were stuck in Bahrain. But I knew the story would be good.
Behave? Good Lord, you must be joking.
Chapter 28 Bad Behaviour. Jake took a sip of beer, ever the showman, timing perfect. Colton, Joe, and I waited.
Good grief. When we arrive in Spain, it's late, and both the kids and teachers are tired. We go out for a brief dinner, and then everyone heads to bed. All good so far. The next morning, I am jolted out of bed by a knock at my door. It's one of the boys, and he tells me, ever so politely, that Miss Rowan needs me right away. So I shower, and then head to the lobby. In the lobby, there's hysteria, mass confusion, and 3 crying and pale teenage girls to greet me. Of course, I am overwhelmed with horrific thoughts as to what could have happened. Did someone die overnight? Did someone go missing? Did someone's parents pass away? Who is sick? Who got raped? What did our boys do now? Being a teacher, you always try to prepare yourself for every outcome. My head slipped into teacher mode for about 5 seconds. That is, until Rowan informed me of the problem. Jake halts his tail to lubricate his throat. The rest of us are smiling. We know this is going to be good. Good grief. Anyway, Rowan is looking at me, all bug-eyed.
"Ghosts, ghosts," she says. "Jacob, we have ghosts in this hotel."
Let's take a moment to review what's happened. The one day we're free to have a sleep in, I am jolted from a deep slumber. Not only do 3 of our girls believe they have had a visitation from malicious spirits, but my leader, my friend, my partner in calmness, also believes this to be true. As politely as I can, I ask, say again, ghosts? I am told that while the girls showered, they heard banging on the windows, the floor, the ceiling, and the walls. I am also informed that as one came out of the shower, she caught sight of a foggy handprint on the mirror. This evidence has led three teenage girls and a responsible adult to construe that the hotel is haunted and Spanish ghosts are having some fun. Good grief. Rowan demands that I immediately arrange for a hotel transfer because we can't endanger the lives of our precious students by succumbing them to the free will of supernatural beings. I'm at a loss for words and can't process all that is being thrown at me. I calmly tell her that we can't transfer because we have already paid in full and that this hotel is part of our scheduled program. Rowan is now staring at me. She's convinced I'm a ghost-loving traitor. Probably with evil powers, who knows. Whatever, I don't side with her, so I am the enemy. She rings our tour guide, Fabio, I think his name is. He tells her the exact same news. She turns a peculiar shade of purple and is beside herself with anger, but quietly fades away back to her room until lunchtime. By lunch, all is forgotten, and Rowan and my students find hundreds of other things to complain about. The food is gross. Paella. There is far too much walking. 3 to 5 miles. They're still hungry and want a McDonald's. We were all laughing, but Jake held his hand up. Wait! Wait! I haven't told you about the mystery of the disappearing students yet. Now this one you won't believe. Good grief.
More ghosts?
Asked Joe. Nope. We took the kids to this really nice restaurant in Malaga to experience a delicious, authentic Spanish meal. Of course, they wanted burgers, but that's not the point. I was sitting with the teachers, and every time I look up, there are kids going to the bathrooms at the back of the restaurant. And the strange thing is, they weren't coming back. Every time I looked, there were less kids sitting at the tables. His eyes grew large at the memory of it.
"Did you check it out?"
asked Colton.
"Did I check it out? Of course I did."
First, I watched. Two boys got up from their table and walked, very nonchalant, to the back of the restaurant. Then they looked around, and instead of opening the door to the boys' bathroom, they slipped through this other door. We were really interested now. So I said excuse me to the other teachers and headed for that door. Dramatic pause.
Well, good grief.
Jake leaned back, clasping his hands behind his head, eyes wide with disbelief. What was it?
Where were the kids? Did you find them?
Yep, I found them.
That door, that blue door, that innocent-looking door at the back of the restaurant.
That door led straight out to a nudist beach. We shouted with laughter as Jake grinned, shaking his head.
I'm telling you, it was like another world. Like walking through the back of the wardrobe in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. Busy Spanish restaurant one side, then this beach on the other side. You know, sand, ocean, people sitting and lying around. And the women are all topless.
Oh, my. I held my hand over my mouth. Well, I look around, and our party is just standing there, eyes on 10-foot stalks. I mean, when does an Arab boy ever get to see a woman apart from her face? They were in a state of shock. They just didn't know where to look next, and their cameras were snapping everything. The girls were giggling hysterically, peeping out from behind their hands, and the boys, well, they just couldn't get enough.
What did you do?
Well, first I had a good look myself. No, only joking. I thought I'd better get them back in before Rowan sussed what was going on. All I could think about were the complaints we were going to get from Mrs. Sherazy and the parents. So I rounded them all up and made them pop back through that door into the restaurant in ones and twos so as not to arouse any suspicions. That summer term was filled with the student silliness, and Irina grew very anxious about graduation day. We were told that in past years the students' behaviour had been appalling. They'd been known to heckle the speakers, throw things, and stampede. It was rumoured that the Gulf Hotel, which hosted the event, had refused to accept this year's booking because of the students' riotous behaviour the year before. I don't know how true that was, but it did again eventually take place at the Gulf Hotel. Darina was in a state of nerves. She spent hours writing her speech, then rehearsing it. With help from an Arabic teacher, she even included a few sentences in Arabic. When she was happy with it, she sent it to Mrs. Sherazi for approval. Mrs. Sherazi summoned her to her office.
"You should see that office, Vicky. It's the size of a tennis court, stuffed with antiques, a table that could seat an army, Persian rugs as thick as duvets, and a forest of potted palms."
"I know. Jake told us about it."
Mrs. Sherazi handed Darina back her speech, and Darina glanced down at it. Red lines had been struck through most of it, including the Arabic sentences she had so carefully rehearsed.
"Short," said Mrs. Sherazi. "Keep it short."
"That's probably because she knows how badly the kids will behave," I said to Darina.
"If I were you," said Joe, "I'd just say a couple of sentences and keep walking as you talk. That way you'll be a moving target when they throw stuff."
Darina smiled thinly.
I don't think Joe's comment helped.
As I was walking out of Mrs. Sherris's office, across those Persian rugs, she suddenly calls me back. "Your blouse," she says, "change it." I said, "Sorry, what's wrong with my blouse?" She points with her pen, and I suddenly understand what she's saying. "You know that black and white top I have with the geometric design?" I nodded. I remembered it, and it was very nice. The back had a tiny slash that briefly revealed a minute glimpse of bra strap when she moved.
"Well, that slash at the back must have offended her," she said. "Jasmine will drive you, and wave me out of the office."
She must have phoned him straight away, because he was waiting for me when I left the building.
"With the bus?"
"Yes, he opened the door and we drove off, even though I was late for a meeting. Anyway, as I'm getting in, Jasmine asks if I'm thirsty." I thought that was nice of him, but I said no, politely. "Are you sure, ma'am?" he says again, and I say no, thank you. Well, he looks really disappointed, but carries on driving. Then, instead of going back to the apartments the usual way, he swings off to this area I've never seen before. It looks really run down with little pokey shops, you know what I mean? I nodded. I'm looking at my watch and wondering where on earth we are going, when Jasmine pulls up outside this little old shop. He jumps out, and I see him buy a brown bottle and slip it into his pocket.
What was it?
I have no idea. So we drive home, and I run inside up to my apartment and quickly change. Then I come out again and see him in the bus, taking crafty swigs from that bottle.
"I'd love to know what it was," said Joe.
"So would I. But I'm guessing it's something frowned upon by Muslims. He drove even faster than usual. That's why I've got this bump on my forehead. I banged my head on the window when he was driving across the sand. I think he was trying to break some speed record." When the time came, Jasmine drove us to the Gulf Hotel. Attending the graduation ceremony was compulsory for teachers. Joe and I were allocated seats amongst the students in the vain hope that we could keep order, should it be necessary. Last year the students had been permitted 4 invitations each, but had manufactured forgeries to invite their friends along too. This time Darina had the tickets numbered. Colton was asked to check off each invitation as the guests arrived, in their Aston Martins and Porsches. Jake, ever confident and a fine public speaker, officiated as master of ceremonies, a task he performed flawlessly. Thanks to Darina's preparation and organisation, the ceremony went fairly smoothly, with very little heckling, and no missiles thrown. When it was over, most of us retired to the bar in relief. Colton and Jake had told us that skip days were common in the US, but I'd never heard of them before. Students took a day off, en masse, the idea being that the sheer numbers of absentees would prevent them from getting into trouble for playing truant.
the younger ASS high school students decided to hold a junior skip day. Jazim and the security guards were alerted, expecting trouble. And it came. Taking advantage of a moment when only one guard stood at the school gate, the truants, wearing hats, masks and fancy dress costumes, stormed in. They stampeded into the school, shouting, blowing horns, and letting off industrial-sized party poppers that fired countless bits of glittery paper into the air. In the courtyard, the wind lifted the shimmering paper squares in clouds, glinting in the sunlight, higher than Joe's classroom window on the second floor. In ran the students, through the high school building, up one flight of stairs and down the other, the security guards, teachers and Saeed in hot pursuit. Mrs. Sherazi appeared and could do nothing but watch, hands on hips, her face set in a severe frown.
I said
Saeed later in Smoker's Corner.
"Couldn't believe it," suggested Colton. "No, I called the police."
Help Joe.
No, I caught one on the stairs and locked him in the stationery cupboard,
said Saeed. The junior stampede ended as soon as it began, leaving the poor Nepalese staff to sweep up the swirling pieces of metallic paper and remove the silly string from the walls. Removing unwanted stuff was also a problem in my classroom. I was sick of my fingers making contact with revolting globs of chewing gum that my little darlings had stuck under their desks. I decided to do something about it. Chapter 29 Brent and Camels. Chewing gum was banned in school, but some kids always flouted the rules. They tried keeping their jaws motionless if they thought I was looking in their direction, but soon forgot, and the chewing action would attract my attention. "Mohammed, are you chewing gum?"
"No, miss."
"Mohammed, are you sure?"
"No, miss, I swear to God."
Of course, within minutes I'd catch him again and order him to spit the gum into the bin. The girls were even more guilty than the boys. Worse still, the little urchins stuck the plugs of gum under the desks and chairs, which infuriated me. Kids from my next class sat down and found it sticking to their clothes.
"Do what I do,"
said Hawa, her eyebrows shooting up into her mauve-embroidered hijab.
"If I see them chewing, I make them stay in lunchtime. I say to them, 'You have a lunch date with Miss Hawa today,' and I tell them, 'Bring rulers.'"
"Do you make them do extra maths?"
"No, not do math. They clean off gum from under desk. They scrape it off with ruler. If they don't bring ruler, they must use hand."
What a good idea. I warned my classes and started a chewing gum punishment list. At the end of the week, I held my first chewing gum detention. Reluctantly, the kids arrived, clutching their rulers. First, I made them turn over all the desks and chairs, revealing the nasty blobs of gum.
"Miss," Amina complained, "that's disgusting, miss."
"Yes, it is. Perhaps it'll teach you not to chew gum in my class in future." It wasn't easy to supervise. Protesting loudly, they began to scrape the gum, but not for long. Soon, Cheeky Mohammed and Mustafa Camel were chasing screaming girls around the classroom with revolting globs of pink gum stuck to the end of their rulers. Eventually, I was satisfied. We put the room back to rights, and the kids ran out into the courtyard to enjoy the rest of their break. But it wasn't only the students who were badly behaved. In fact, they were saints, compared with some of the high school teachers. A group of younger teachers frequently played truant, nursing hangovers, or simply deciding to take days off. Some of them even flew to Dubai for a rock concert, much to the fury of Jake, Colton and Joe, who had to cover their classes. Always short of teachers, Direna was forced to use Crazy Brent, but soon regretted her decision. As usual, Brent insisted on spelling each name out, and the students were losing patience.
He did a head count, compared it with his list, and discovered there were more students in the room than there should have been. Some of the students, although not supposed to be there, had come to sit with their friends. More students tried to come in, and Brent lost the plot. He sprang to the door and slammed it shut, preventing anybody else from entering. Legitimate students, arriving late, tried to open the door, but Brent was having none of it.
"Mr. Brent, let us in," they called. "We're supposed to be having a lesson in there now."
"Go away. No more students."
The students knocked on the door.
"Mr. Brent, open the door. Let us in."
"Go away. No more students."
Brent jammed the door closed with his foot. The students already in the room were becoming uneasy, and the illegal ones decided it was time to get out. Brent refused to move. The students outside were now banging on the door, shouting to be let in, and the ones inside were shouting to be let out. Brent just kept his foot in place and blocked the door. The students inside began to panic. The commotion in the corridor attracted Dorina's attention, and she demanded an explanation.
"We've got a lesson in there and we can't get in," the students complained. "The door is blocked."
"Stand aside," she ordered, and rapped on the door.
"Open this door now."
At that point, she believed students were preventing entry, and that they were unattended. It never occurred to her that it was the teacher. But Brent's foot stayed in place.
"Mister, it's the principal. You've got to open the door,"
the shocked kid said from inside.
"Mister, it's the principal. Open the door,"
yelled the kids outside. Whether Brent didn't hear, or didn't understand, we'll never know, but his foot remained in place. Dorina shoved the door as hard as she could, assisted by a couple of burly students. A gap revealed enough of Brent's shoe for her to realize he was blocking the door, not the students. Reluctantly, he opened the door and allowed her in. She sent him to her office to calm down, and found someone else to cover the lesson. Brent was one of our favourite topics at Bennigan's. He was always doing something for us to marvel at. And on the bus, Sadja made us laugh with yet another crazy Brent story. "Brent was in the next classroom," she began, "and the noise was just awful. I could hardly hear myself speak. He's got no control, you know."
"That man is dreadful," Joe grumbled. "I don't know what he's doing in teaching."
Sadja nodded. "Ralph, the geography teacher, is opposite, and the noise is disturbing him too. So Ralph walks across and politely asks Brent if he'd mind keeping the noise down as his kids are sitting an exam. Brent just ignores him, and the noise continues, worse if anything. So Ralph goes over again and complains. Brent looks at him and says, 'I'm perfectly aware that you don't like me, but there's no call to take that tone.' Well, Ralph gets annoyed, and it soon breaks into a slanging match between the two of them. Ralph is swearing, and Brent is shouting. Both of their classroom doors are open, and their kids can hear it all." Joe and I listened, agog. "So I thought I'd better get out there to try and intervene, calm them down if I could. I go over and say, 'Guys, guys, there's no need for this, you know.'"
Joe and I smiled at each other. We imagined the scene. Ralph and Brent, two huge, angry men, dwarfing the gentle and softly spoken Sadja.
"Now my class are listening too," she continued. "Well, it takes a while. They're shouting and insulting each other, and I'm trying to stop them. Eventually they calm down a bit and walk off into their own classrooms." "I'm glad it didn't come to blows," I said.
"I think it nearly did," said Sadja.
"Anyway, I went back into my classroom, and my class are all big-eyed because they've been listening, and ask, 'Miss, which students were fighting?'
And I have to say, it wasn't the students. It was the teachers."
Strangely, Brent and his new roommate, Ibekwe, managed to coexist quite well in their apartment. Dorina guessed that was because Ibekwe was a bit of a bully, and left rules and labels pasted everywhere. Perhaps Brent had met his match. The weather grew hotter as we hurtled into summer. We'd begun before the real heat set in. The heat that could melt the glue holding one's shoes together. The days in Bahrain were slipping through our fingers like desert sand.
"Joe, we still haven't been to see the King's camels," I said as we sat with Colton and Jake in Bennigan's.
"Hey, why don't we go this weekend?"
Jake suggested.
"An outing with the grandparents."
They often referred to us as the grandparents because of the huge age difference between us.
"I'd love that," I said, "and look forward to it. Perhaps we could ride on one."
It worried me that I'd told my listeners, jokingly at first, that my book about our stay in Bahrain would be called Two Old Fools on a Camel. The title had stuck, but we hadn't ridden or even seen a single camel. I felt as if I'd been fraudulent or transgressed the Trade Description Act.
Perhaps here was an opportunity to set that to rights, with a ride on one of the King's camels. Colton and Jake drove us there, and we sang songs, including Afternoon Delight, which still made me squirm. Was it really almost a year ago since that joke began? How much had happened since then? The King keeps 450 camels on a farm that is open to the public every day.
Perhaps farm is not the best description, as the place is just dry sand, and the farmhouse is the King's palace, hidden by trees behind extremely high walls. However, astonishingly green plants grow in fields alongside the camel compound, fodder, I assume, for the camels. How water is provided for the trees, crops, and camels, I do not know. But when money is no object, I guess anything is possible. The heat hammered us as we left the cool of the air-conditioned car and walked through the entrance gates and passed a sign that read, "Notice. 1. Please keep safe distance from the camels. 2. Throwing unwanted material or hitting camels are strictly prohibited. 3. Photography to be taken by keeping safe distance. 4. Feeding of camels are not allowed under any circumstances. 5. Free admission. By order security."
Camels, the colour of desert sand, were everywhere. Some were tethered, others hobbled, their front legs loosely tied together. Small herds milled about in separate enclosures, and the sound of camel grunts and flatulence filled the air. I expected the place to smell, and the flies to be a pest, but that wasn't the case.
"Why would the King want so many camels?" Joe wondered. "Do they race them? Or eat camel meat?"
"I don't think so," I said, having researched a little. "Camel meat is very strong. I don't think it tastes nice at all. I think he keeps them because they're a symbol of wealth and position from bygone days."
We walked close, but not too close, to big tethered males in the centre of the compound. They reared their heads as we passed, looking down at us from hooded eyes. Indian staff in mule carts forked out piles of green vegetation for the camels to graze on.
We visited various enclosures and saw lady camels, teenage camels, young camels, old camels, and pregnant camels. Colton slipped a worker, 2BD, to allow us into a pen with mother and baby camels. The babies stared at us with liquid eyes, then turned to drink from their haughty, loose-lipped mothers. I'm very fond of camels. I like their snooty attitude and beautiful eyes, fringed with thick lashes.
I fell in love with one particularly gorgeous camel I named Camilla, who seemed to have a permanent smile.
"Can't we take her back to Spain?" I asked Joe. "I'm sure the King wouldn't notice just one missing. We could tether her with Uncle Felix's mule in the village."
Camels chewing, camels drinking, camels standing, sitting, kicking, dozing, dreaming, playing. Noisy camels, silent camels, foaming camels, defecating camels, flatulent camels. I wanted to walk around the entire compound and see them all.
"Come on," said Joe, sweat pouring down his face. "Let's go. Once you've seen one camel, you've seen the lot."
But I had my way, and we strolled around under the beating sun, and I happily snapped camel photo after camel photo.
So, did we ride a camel?
I'm afraid not, although we would have given the opportunity. So I apologize if this book's title is misleading. I suppose it should have been titled Two Old Fools in Bahrain. But it isn't. Suddenly, it was the last week of term. We packed all our possessions into large cardboard boxes and shipped them back to Spain. It surprised me how much stuff we'd acquired during the year. The middle school students were supposed to sit an external exam, but the question papers were held up in customs, much to their delight. The last day was a fun day, which was great fun for the students, not so much for the teachers. On the last school day, I took a deep breath and gazed round my classroom. I was astonished at how fond I'd grown of my students. Cheeky Mohammed, Mustafa Kamel, Ahmed, Silent Huda, Fatima, Khaled, Zainab, Amina. I'd missed them all. Many had given me gifts that day. Little camels, chocolates, and pretty candles. Somehow I'd have to squeeze them into my suitcase. The final bell rang, and the class exploded out into the corridor, whooping with excitement. Escape! The school holidays had begun. One child trailed behind. It was Huda. She raised her face to meet my eyes, the first time she'd ever looked at me directly. I'd never noticed what huge, beautiful brown eyes she had.
"Goodbye, Miss Vicky," she whispered. "I'll miss you."
I opened my mouth, but it was my turn to be tongue-tied. By the time I'd collected myself, she'd run out of the classroom and my life forever. Chapter 30 Home. The students may have left, but I still had work to do. I cleared my desk and threw away unclaimed assignments, broken pencils, and all the other clutter that accumulates in teachers' desk drawers. Some other teacher would be sitting at this desk in future. I came across Huda's homework exercise book and shook my head. Why had she handed in an empty exercise book every single week? I flicked through the pages, preparing to throw it into the rubbish bin. To my astonishment, I found homework assignment after homework assignment. They were poorly written and riddled with spelling mistakes, but they were all there, dating back from the beginning of the school year. Why hadn't I seen them? I hadn't seen them because Huda had written in the book in the Arabic way, from the back to the front. I'd opened it normally, and it had appeared empty to me. Saying goodbye to Hawa was very hard. We hugged, and I felt the soft chiffon of her hijab against my face.
"Thank you for everything," I said tearfully. "You've been a wonderful friend."
"You keep in touch," she said. "You know where I am. I be here at ASS for many year. You see."
Mr. Brewster shook my hand. He began, looking uncomfortable and staring over my shoulder at a point on the far wall.
"I'm not very good at saying these things, but I've been very pleased with your work. I'm sorry to see you go."
One last visit to Smoker's Corner, to see Joe and our friends, and await Jasim with the bus. Yusuf gave us an Egyptian keychain with tiny camels and pyramids hanging from it.
"Goodbye, my friends," he said. "Enjoy your retirement in Spain, and think of us here at ASS next year."
"And you enjoy your summer with your wife and triplets," I said. Said stood up and clasped Joe's hand warmly with both of his.
"Safe journey,"
suggested Joe, smiling.
"No, see you,"
helped Colton.
"No, soccer season starts soon, Mr. Joe. I'll be watching Liverpool and thinking of you."
Essam was too upset to say anything. Joe kissed him, Arabic style, on each cheek, and I shook his hand. Rashida clocked round the corner.
"Ah, good," she said. "You're still here. I want to catch you. I am going to Mall now to buy a little dinner, but I have forget my purse. Please lend me 2 BD.
Jo handed her a 5 BD note, which she snatched with grubby fingers. "Goodbye, everyone," we said, and walked away to punch our cards for the last time.